Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1. With Olay Total Effects Age-Defying Day Cream. Over 100 awards without paying hundreds of euros.
First this morning, as we know, for some lockdown, well, it's been a period of reflection and creativity, and it has been that for Carl Corcoran, singer-songwriter, former presenter, of course, here on Lyric FM, and now he is director of the Masters in Songwriting at the University of Limerick, and he joins me now. Good morning, Carl.
Good morning, Miriam. Lovely to be with you.
Thanks so much for joining us. Listen, before we talk, because you've been writing songs again, you, of course, when I was doing my research, were called Jamie Stone in the 70s, and you were a very successful singer-songwriter.
Back in the Stone Age, indeed, yeah. 45 years ago now, it's hard to believe. I had a great opportunity as a young 20-year-old to be offered a recording contract with EMI. And from 74 to 78, I managed to write and record three albums with success in the early days with a song called Gulliver, co-written by myself and my brother Michael. And in later times, a song called I Believe in Love, which was a co-write with Pat Abernethy and myself, which was number one in Ireland for 6 weeks. So it was a very roller coaster 4 years that ended in 78 when I headed across the Atlantic and started a 20-year career in America before returning to Ireland in 99. And I've been here since, involved in many different areas and aspects of the music business, including radio in the very studio that you're probably working from this morning.
Yeah.
So it's been an exciting 45 years of a variety of elements of the music business.
Yeah, fascinating.
And my most recent...
Yeah, go on, Carl.
And my most recent experience, of course, has been as course director of the Masters in Songwriting at the Irish World Academy in the University of Limerick, which has been an exciting 3 years and proves to be even more exciting as we go online now for the next while due to the new world that we find ourselves in.
Yeah, and you run, of course, the Masters in Songwriting. First of all, how difficult is it to teach someone how to songwrite? And what are you doing differently now? Is it just because it's all online at the moment?
Yeah, the course was set up in 2017. And for the last 3 years, we've done it on campus, obviously, in the creative hub that is the Irish World Academy. And because of the situation that we now find ourselves in, necessity is the mother of invention. And we now find ourselves in an online environment, which is proving to be very successful. And I'm very optimistic that it can be delivered in that environment. As regards teaching how to write songs, I prefer to look on the course as more why we write songs. And it's an investigation and an opportunity for songwriters to delve into themselves, a little introspection, a little self-reflection and an interrogation of what their arts practice is. You can certainly instruct in various templates and procedures in terms of what a song is made up of in its structure. But very often, something like this is really a development of what we already have, an ability to put a song together, but more importantly, to understand why we're writing the songs and what we're trying to say. So it's a case of encouraging people to find their voice, and I mean by voice not just the vocal production of the voice, but more the philosophical reasons why we are doing it and what we're trying to say. So yes, you can. You know, I mean, if you wanted to write a song, Miriam, we could sit down in 10 minutes and we would come up with the structure of a song that would give you the opportunity.
Oh, I'd
have
be
the
dire.
Piano here, so we can do it.
Now, you have written a song during lockdown, and we're going to listen to some. But tell us about it. Tell us what it's called and what it's about.
Well, the song came about, one of the silver linings of this recent experience that we've all been through has been the opportunity to slow down, do a little reflection and perhaps a little readjustment of who we are and what we do. And I found it particularly inspiring to take those moments of reflection and to return to something that I did all those years ago, but hadn't been able to do much when I was in the broadcasting world, because most of my energy was directed towards curating and producing the programs. But I find in the last 3 years, and particularly in the last 3 months, I have found a rekindling of the inspiration to write songs. And this song, which is still in progress, so to speak, as our mutual friend Brendan Graham and a mentor of mine would say, the heavy lifting has to be done, and the heavy lifting is the polishing of the work. But it came out of the recognition that we as a society had come together. We had banded together with a common purpose, and that purpose was to feel the power of love, which is the title of the song, because the display of humanity and solidarity that we saw in the reaction to the lockdown, in terms of frontline workers and the attitude that this common humanity that we expressed, our human kindness, inspired me to come up with a song that was a recognition of that, because that's what we've become. We've become a very loving society, and if we can continue to use that readjustment to bring about a new world, I think it's the ambition that we should all strive for.
Well, look, Carl, thanks so much for taking the time to speak to me this morning. Congrats on your success in the Masters in Songwriting, running it down in UL, that wonderful university. And we're going to listen now. And you would say yourself, it's a bedroom version, so it isn't completely finished. But we're going to listen to some of this lovely song yours you've written during lockdown. Mind Yourself, Carl. And it's called To Feel the Power of Love.
Morning light streams softly through my window. Through the night, I've prayed for peace within. Hear the planet cry, its gentle heart still beating, holding tight to feel the power of love. From deep within, I feel my spirit stronger. Until it is our only choice, no greater power for change than knowing what we care for. We begin to feel the power of love. We band together with
that lovely song, To Feel the Power of Love, written by Carl Corcoran and sung by him. It's a bedroom version of that song he wrote in lockdown. So thanks to him, to Carl, for introducing us to that song today and for chatting to me earlier. Good morning, Paul Costello.
Good morning, Miriam. Lovely to be talking to you on a sunny morning in London, believe it or not.
It's a bit chilly in Dublin, I have to say, but...
Yeah, we had a torrential rains yesterday, so the air is fresh again, thanks be to God, and
Thanks
not
so much...
Bad, not bad.
...for joining us. I'm just interested, because I was reading things you were saying. What impact, Paul, do you think, you know, the pandemic, COVID-19, will have on the fashion business, both in the short and the long term?
Well, I believe that the new normal is going to change. As a fact, your predecessor just said readjustment. Well, this definitely applies in retail. And I just think it's going to be difficult. It's going to be slow. It's going to be probably expensive for the retailers, particularly for the smaller retailer, that single little store on the local high street. I believe the distancing is going to continue. So, yes, it's going to take major adjustments. It is happening already. It was, in fact, happening to some extent when you take stores like IKEA, not even like IKEA, like Nike and Apple stores. What you see on the shop store on the shop the display is not what you get. It's all going to be a different experience that you're going to receive your item at the end at the customer desk, and it'll be all beautifully wrapped, and you'll have a whole new experience of unwrapping something. It's going to be exciting. It's going to be different, and it's going to be tough.
You've been very successful in the business for decades, Paul. Is this the most difficult time you think the fashion industry has experienced, or not?
Miriam, it probably is. I've always had the ups and downs of the fashion industry and the highs and the lows. Yes, I think it is definitely certainly from my experience, the most difficult period. But in difficult periods comes opportunities. Again, like your previous guest said, it's a time to review what we're doing, how we're living, how we're going to go shopping into that retail store. I think a lot of people are going to be making decisions on their iMac or on their on their phones, on any technology is going to rule. And so people are going to be more prepared rather than, you know, piling a pile of garments into a changing room and start trying them all on. They will have had the technology is going to give people so much help in decision making that they will go in the store, they will look and see what they're already seen on their phone. Or on their laptop, or whatever way they're going to be working, and then they will select from there. But nearly decisions will be made to some extent prior to going into the stores, and that store is going to be a monument of what they stand for. It's going to be like it'll be more theatrical. It'll be more exciting. It'll be more. The demanding from the maintenance of the stores, display, etc. You know, even we're talking fashion shows. It'll be virtual shows. Things are moving too fast for me, Miriam. But I'm enjoying the change.
So when you say, in other words, do you think people will be buying just more online, Paul, going in, seeing things put up beautifully, but not necessarily buying in stores? And as you say, I notice already some collections are saying, the big houses are saying it'll be almost seasonless and they won't be having, as you say, catwalk shows.
Well, that's what they're saying, Miriam, as of today. Tomorrow it could change, believe me. Fashion is a very fickle industry. And I wouldn't guarantee on that. They could end up going right back to the traditional fashion show. But yes, I think the consumer is going to be more selective. She will have spent more time making a decision prior to going into the store. So the bricks and mortar of that store is really a data space now. And there'll also be the evolution of loyalty, of keeping your customer is going to be more important than ever. And Amazon, of course, who has been dictating the modern buying format, is now going into luxury fashion, which is interesting. And they've already opened up a store in New York. So Amazon is the biggie, you know. It's a monster. And Nike and all those major companies are already moving in that direction, and they were moving prior to COVID.
How have you found lockdown, Paul? I've interviewed you before, and every interview, like, you like to remain very active. You get up early, you cycle to your office. How have you found lockdown?
What you expect me?
Have you found it difficult?
I think that's a bit of a vision, yes. Lately, during lockdown, I've been getting up late. I've been having breakfast with my four handsome boys, which are living in at the moment. And then I've trotted off on my bike, yes, by about 11 o'clock. I'm afraid I'm no angel. But it's just trying to recover, review, and of course keeping the designer factor moving in whatever situation. You if you have to divert, you have to divert. But it's interesting times, and unfortunately I had to lay off a number of my staff onto furlough. Thanks be to goodness, furlough has been a great help for the last couple of months, and I hope to get my team all back in July. It's been a humbling but interesting experience. But it certainly is an opportunity, Miriam, to retire. It's a great time to say, "All right, I've had enough," But in fact, on the contrary, I've decided I won't make a living playing golf or playing tennis. So I've decided I'll stick with fashion and art for the moment.
Good. One of our listeners, Sheila, says, "Hi, Miriam. Please tell Paul I bought a lovely pair of navy trousers for my husband from his collection in Dunn Stores yesterday, and they're lovely on him."
Oh, good. He's probably got a good figure. Well done. Well done. <He's
laughs> I love live radio.
I think we've certainly over here, I've never seen so many people out jogging. It's unreal, it's crazy. And I just came back from the heat now this morning. The heat is like a park, but it's quite wide. And there were people doing every kind of exercise out on the grass. So, and even people said good morning this morning, which was a change. And normally the English don't even say good morning. So it's been a bit of a revelation every day. You get up, you don't know what to expect.
Final question to you, Paul. Have you found anything out about yourself during this lockdown time? Anything about yourself that you've discovered?
Not flying off every... my wings were clipped, absolutely, for the last 3 months. And being at home on a regular basis in the evening, having dinner, it's been... A wonderful occasion, really. I think from that point of view, it's been reviewed some of my values. But I'm still not perfect, I'm afraid.
No, well, look, Paul, thanks so much. I hope all works out well and that fashion does come back.
I love your family, Miriam. Great to talk to you, and thank you for everything. You're a great asset to Ireland, and long may you last. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Paul. Take care. One of our listeners in Port Marnock says, "Paul Costello is a great ambassador of fashion for Ireland. It's great to hear that he's not retiring." And another says, "Great to hear Carl Corcoran on radio again. I miss his dulcet tones from Lyric FM. Terrible pity he had to leave radio." That's from Frank in Dublin. Well, my next guest this morning is Cathy Jordan from the traditional music group Dervish, and she's going to talk to us all about the upcoming Cuinneann an Óg event that's taking place next Saturday, online, of course. Good morning, Cathy. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Miriam. How are you doing?
Great. Where are you talking to me from?
I'm talking to you from the northwest Sligo.
What's it like there this morning?
Well, it's a bit dull and overcast and windy, but better than it was yesterday. So it's not so bad. We've had a great run of it here, and we're so lucky that the weather has been just phenomenal.
Is that where you've spent most of the lockdown, Cathy, down in Sligo?
Yes. We legged it, having to give up our tour of America to settle back into the northwest. So there were scary times, but no better place to be locked away than in Sligo, I would say.
Oh, beautiful. Now, listen, tell us about, you're all hoping to inspire the younger generation. Tell us a bit about Cuinneann an Óg, of course, and it's happening next Saturday and your involvement in it, Cathy.
Yeah, well, Cuinneann an Óg has been going a few years, and it's a kind of a way of getting young people involved in creativity, and there's a National Day of Free Creativity for the under 18s on the 13th of June. So there's many elements in that, and the element that I am involved in is a thing called Kaylee in the Kitchen, which was an initiative by a powerhouse of a lassie from Leitrim by the name of Edwina Gokian. And Edwina, no more than myself, grew up on Kaylee's in the Kitchen and sing songs. And sadly, they're not as popular or as common as they were in when we were younger. So this was a way to recreate that festive atmosphere in your own house with your own family or your friends, neighbours, whatever. And particularly in these days with your little unit that you're locked down with. So we were teaching the skills. There was four of us involved in Kaylee in the Kitchen. So Edwina was looking after the dance part of it. And Mickle Murphy was looking after the storytelling. And Thomas Johnson, he was on all the musical instruments, and myself on the singing and the songs. So then the whole lot would culminate in the youth being able to have their own Kaylee in their own kitchens and involve their friends and neighbours and family.
And you've been doing it on Facebook mainly, isn't it, Cathy?
Facebook and Arc Dowsa is the... You can log on to arcdowsa.com and Crinan and Oak as well. You can find the lessons there. The lessons have been ongoing every week, but the Kaylee in the Kitchen then will be happening on the 13th of June around the country with everyone that's involved in taking part. So it's a great initiative. I mean, Kaylee's and sing songs were such a huge part of our lives, and it's very hard to quantify all they did for me as a youth in bringing family and friends together, young and old. And, you know, it was a great community thing to do. And, you know, all the songs that have all our memories kind of locked away in them, and just a way of unlocking all that stuff. And yeah, all these years have passed, and I still, some of my happiest memories were thinking of those sing songs and Kaylee's.
And did you have a particular party piece, or were there different songs you sang when you were growing up in these Kaylee's?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. We'd all be encouraged to have a party piece. I mean, I was the youngest of seven, so and my parents sang as well. So my father would sing Eileen McMahon. My brother would sing The Town I Love So Well. My sister Marie, God rest her, she'd sing Old Ballymore. I would sing The Bunch of Violets. You know, so we all had, I had a repertoire at the age of three. So it was very much something we look forward to and took part in, and, you know, were dying to do our party pieces.
Why do you think it's died away, that, Cathy, the Kaylee in the Kitchen?
Well, I guess technology has a lot to do with it. I mean, mobile phones and TVs and, you know, people are finding other ways to spend their time. And gradually then you forget how important those little gatherings were until, you know, they're gone from your memory in a lot of ways, until somebody rejogs your memory with a song. And when the lockdown started, I started these Facebook sing song, where I started singing all the songs that I learned as a kid. And it's amazing how it rekindled all the people that were listening from around the world, their memories of who sang them and where, and it invoked all their happy memories of childhood, of an aunt or an uncle or a cousin or a mother or father. Happy memories, and the songs are very reassuring, and so I think it's a huge, very important part of my youth, and I think it's a great thing to rekindle again, and I think it's a wonderful initiative.
So next Saturday, June the 13th, which is the day of Crinan an Óg, and it's run, of course, by both the government and RTÉ is very involved. And anyone who wants to find out about it, it's crinu.creativeireland.gov.ie or rte.ie. What will you teach children about tradition, Cathy, and the joy of a sing song for Saturday? What will you be saying to them?
Well, there was four lessons involved. So the first one was all the elements, we'll say, of the ingredients to make a good Kaylee in the Kitchen. And just a little bit of background of how it would go, and maybe you'd move back the tables and the chairs, and the kitchen was always the hub and the heartland of the sing-song or the ceilidh. So you'd make that the epicenter, and so just those little backgrounds first, and then maybe to teach them their own party piece, to look at songs like that have pride of place at the centre of them. So to maybe look at all the things that they're proud of in their home place, and to write a song about those little elements, to have that as their party piece. I can't even remember now the other two lessons, but they're all there online to tap into, so they can. And the same goes for Michael Murphy's storytelling classes and Edwina's dance classes and Thomas's. So all the elements are there, and you put them all together to have a great party.
And we're also going to hear a beautiful song you wrote with Brendan Graham. Funny enough, we were talking about Brendan Graham earlier as well, with Cara Corcoran. Tell me about this song, Cathy, of yours and his, you wrote, called All the Way Home.
Well, the song is called... I think the song is called The Road I Go. It's from the album All the Way Home. And we wrote it with the in mind, the songs that you grow up with, holding your memories and you carrying them with you like a little mm-hmm. piece of gold on through your life, holding those memories until such time as you create a new song for yourself, and you never be afraid because of the great foundation that you were given through the songs.
Well, we'll listen to that. Before I let you go, how have you found lockdown? Have you found it difficult, or have you found yourself being very creative?
Well, I really have enjoyed it. I mean, it's the first time in years I haven't been living out of a suitcase or three suitcases, you know, the one for short trips, the one for week trips, the one for month trips. So that has been great to just settle and, you know what you're, what's on the menu every day, and just do one shop a week. And it's very, I found it very settling after a while. And I did the 60 days of lockdown sing-song, which was great as well. That really, I found that really settling. Great overall, really, Miriam. I can't complain. It's just nice to be reflective and nice to clean out the cupboards and nice to think of all the stuff you've been hoarding over the years that are unnecessary to your life. And you just kind of reflect a bit more on what it is that's important.
Yeah, so true, actually. Well, look, Cathy, thanks so much for joining us this morning. And as I say, Crinian and Oak, happening next Saturday. Anyone who wants to go on the websites. And now we're going to listen to that beautiful song of yours and Brendan Graham's, Cathy, The Road I Go.
I have travelled all across the ocean, a lonely stranger, on foreign shores, far from the old ones who love me dearly, far from the one place that I call home. I have wandered forbidden cities, made my wish by the wailing wall, threw my silver in the Rio Grande, offer my dream of going home. Maybe it's the mountains above the valley, maybe it's the long road that winds on down, maybe it's the sunbeams that kiss the water, maybe it's you that keeps calling me home. I know that someday my heart will take me to the old ground where my loved ones rest, and you put your arms like a coat around me in the one place that I call home. Maybe it's the mountains above.
Well, race relations have simmered in the US since the first slaves were taken from Africa in 1619. Racism is the fault line in America, which erupts every now and then. And right now, of course, it's because of the horrific killing of George Floyd. But there are other many deep-seated grievances, including poverty and inequality at the heart of this current civil unrest. And joining me now to discuss all of this is the human rights activist and lawyer, Kerry Kennedy. Kerry's father, Bobby Kennedy, was, of course, assassinated in 1968. And she's now president of the not-for-profit Robert F. Kennedy Human Rights in Washington. Good morning, Kerry Kennedy. Thanks so much for joining us.
I'm so happy to be here. Thank you.
Listen, a quote from your late father. He said at one stage, when you teach a man to hate and to fear his brother, when you teach that he is a lesser man because of his colour, then you also learn to confront others, not as fellow citizens, but as enemies. What do you think, Kerry, your dad would make of the events of the past few weeks in the States?
Well, I'm sure that he would be extremely disappointed that on April 4th, 1968, when Martin Luther King died, we had riots in 125 cities across the United States. And Dover, Delaware was under martial law for 9 months. I think that nobody could imagine that 52 years later, we would again have protests across our country, in cities and small towns across our country, again, because of racial injustice. I think that he would condemn the police violence that's continued to happen, the fact that our mass criminalization system separates families and sends 1 in 3 black men to prison, where 60% of the 2.3 million people caged each night are people of color, and the extraordinary inequities within our society that continue to this day.
What is the problem? Everyone's asking that, but I mean, it's not just obviously Donald Trump and Republicans. There have been Democratic governments as well. Kerry, I mean, is it just a systemic problem more rooted in poverty and inequality? And that's what leads to the racism. What is the problem?
Well, I think it's rooted primarily in a system of slavery that upon which our country was built. The systemic injustice against black people in particular have continued unabated, and the violence against black people has never stopped. The suspicion, the anger, the injustice that has reached. And then there's also another track where white political leaders and financial leaders and other leaders in society have enriched themselves, whether consciously or unconsciously, by playing on racist fears. You hear a lot about the right to bear arms in the United States. Mm-hmm. That's just code for white supremacy. And that is why President Trump evoked the Second Amendment last week, a few days ago, before he sent military troops to fire tear gas and rubber bullets against lawful, peaceful demonstrators up inside the White House so he could hold up a Bible. Mm. You know, that's appealing to that white supremacist leanings and that fear of black.
And I suppose those images, Kerry, of those police officers, you know, the knee on George Floyd's neck and the others leaning on his chest. In this country, we would find it really hard to understand how police officers behave like that. Are they just reflective of a small group within the police, or is that very endemic in police forces in the US?
Yeah, it's endemic in the US society at large. That's what it's not limited. God, wouldn't it be great if it was just the police department?
If it was just the police department, then we wouldn't have this in the public school system, and we wouldn't have the racial wealth gap in the U.S., where 40% of black children live in poverty, which is a rate that's twice as high as among whites. And the median wealth for white families in the United States is 10 times that of black families. This is not just the police. It is also uniquely within the police because the police are trained to carry guns and use violence.
And on that, Kerry, I know I mentioned it earlier, but that is a systemic structural problem almost in the entire country in how it's structured. I mean, one of the wealthiest, if not the wealthiest country in the world, has this massive group of African Americans in BAME, and they are so poor. I mean, and that has happened over decades through many different types of governments, Democrat and Republican. Why has nothing changed? And surely your dad would be shocked if he was around today that so little has changed.
There have been changes. So let's just be clear about that. There have been changes, but it hasn't gone far enough. And black people are killed by police at more than twice the rate as white Americans, but white Americans are arrested more than black people. So what is going on? I think my dad said in a speech at the Cleveland City Club, which incidentally I think was one of his greatest speeches, he said, there's another kind of violence, slower but just as deadly and destructive as the shot or the bomb in the night. And this is the violence of institutions, indifference, inaction, and slow decay. This is the violence that afflicts the poor, that poisons relations between men because their skin is different colors. It's the slow destruction of a child by hunger and schools without books and homes without heat in the winter. And that's the violence that is, it's the violence of institutions that we have to fix.
Let's listen now to some of that speech, Kerry, of your dad.
What has violence ever accomplished? What has it ever created? No martyr's cause has ever been stilled by an assassin's bullet. No wrongs have ever been righted by riots and civil disorders. A sniper is only a coward, not a hero. And an uncontrolled or uncontrollable mob is only the voice of madness, not the voice of the people. Among free men, said Abraham Lincoln, there can be no successful appeal from the ballot to the bullet. And those who take such appeal are sure to lose their case and pay the cost. Violence breeds violence. Repression breeds retaliation. And only a cleansing of our whole society can remove this sickness from our souls. For there is another kind of violence, slower, but just as deadly destructive as the shot or the bomb in the night. This is the violence of institutions, indifference, inaction, and decay. This is the violence that afflicts the poor, that poisons relations between men because their skin has different colors. This is the slow destruction of a child by hunger and schools without books and homes without heat in the winter. This is the breaking of a man's spirit by denying him the chance to stand as a father and as a man amongst other men. But we can perhaps remember, if only for a time, that those who live with us are our brothers, and surely we can begin to work a little harder to bind up the wounds among us and to become in our hearts brothers and countrymen once again.
That's such a wonderful speech from your father, Robert F. Kennedy. Tell me about that speech, how it came about, do you know?
So it's actually a very interesting story. So on April 4th, 1968, Daddy was campaigning in Indiana, which is in the middle of our country, and vastly white. But in Indianapolis, there was a very large African-American population. And my father was supposed to go give a speech, a rally in a park to in the African-American neighborhood. And it was set up by John Lewis, who is the great freedom rider, civil rights activist, current congressman. And he arrived in Indianapolis, and he was told that Martin Luther King had been shot and killed. And he got a call from the mayor, the white mayor of Indianapolis, Richard Lugar. And Richard Lugar had never been to that neighborhood. He's the mayor. He'd never been to the black neighborhood. And he said, you can't go there because it's too dangerous. We have riots in 125 cities across the country. If you choose to go there, I won't send my police because as an escort because it's too dangerous. And my father had worked with black communities across our country for years and years in the midst of the civil rights movement. He had and afterwards he had spent time in Bedford-Stuyvesant, in Watts, in the Mississippi Delta, in the poorest parts of our country, and in African-American communities, and had worked side by side with local community organizers. And he said to the mayor, that might be too dangerous for you to go, or it didn't say it might be too dangerous. Hmm. He said, maybe you can't go there, but I could go there tonight with my wife and my pregnant wife and my 10 children and sleep on the streets and nothing would happen to us. And he got in his car and he went to that crowd and he gave an impassioned speech. The next day, white city fathers across the country said, now the blacks have rioted in our cities. We don't owe them anything. We don't have to meet any of their demands. And my father wanted to react to that. And so he canceled all of his campaign stops. But then he went to the Cleveland, except for one, he went to the Cleveland City Club, which is a bastion of white power in the city of Cleveland, Ohio, also in the middle of the country. And he gave a speech, which we call the Mindless Menace of Violence speech. And he talked about the structures of racism, which were the bulwark of the power of white people and which had suppressed black people, and which white people had a obligation to dismantle. And that's what he went to say at that speech. And it's an amazing speech.
It's an amazing. Is that your favorite speech of your father, Kerry?
Oh, hard to say, because I love that speech.
Yeah.
And I both of those facts, they sort of go together. The Indianapolis speech and the Cleveland City Club, and there's another one that he gave in South Africa in 1966, in which he talked about a ripple of hope and the capacity of one person to make a difference, and that you don't have to change history to make a difference. You can change a small event.
Each time a man stands up for an ideal or acts to improve the lot of others or strikes out against injustice, he sends forth a tiny ripple of hope, and crossing each other from a million different centers of energy and daring, those ripples build a current which can sweep down the mightiest walls of oppression and resistance.
Beautiful image, great speech, and very wonderful description of democracy, and also really interesting analysis in that speech of why things don't change and how to overcome them. It's a great speech.
Absolutely. I'm conscious, especially when we think of that Cleveland speech we played a short while ago, Kerry, that it was only 2 months later that your own father was assassinated.
Yeah, that's true.
There's such a faction in Ireland for your family. You know that, Kerry.
You know, I'm named after County Kerry.
Oh, I love it. Do you remember your father well? You were 8, I think, were you?
I was 8, but we were very, very close. You know, I always felt like I was kind of, I was his favorite. But and then I thought, well, everybody thought they were his favorite. And then I looked at a lot of pictures, and sure enough, I am always in his lap. He's always holding on to me, or I'm sitting on his shoulders or something. He's always surrounded by kids, but I'm always the one who's
that's so lovely,
meandered
isn't it?
Up and gotten closest to him.
That's so lovely,
it's
though.
So great. I have to say, it's really nice. Yeah, I felt very close to him, and I have a lot of memories of him. You know, it's funny because I can't say I have a lot of memories of my mother from that age. But I think when you lose a parent at that age, you those memories get frozen. And you think about them so much, and that they stay with you. Anyway, that's what happened to me. So I have a lot of great memories of him.
Is it hard to grieve as a child when the whole world is grieving for your father? I mean, does it become almost like, I don't know, that you're sharing your grief with the world or something? And has your grief changed over the decades for him, Kerry?
I think, you know, that's a good question. I think that in some ways it's the most private moment, and but the privacy is not there. On the other hand, so many people have been willing to, total strangers, walk up to me and tell me about the worst moments of their life with the loss that they've felt, because they know that I'm somebody who's going to be empathic towards that. And I think that, you know, that's a form of blessing. That's a gift from God to have that connection with it. The two things all of us get in life is we get suffering and we get love. And you understand a lot of that love through joy, but you also understand a lot of that love through sharing of loss and people's willingness to share their loss and their grief and their sadness with me, I feel has been a real gift.
Absolutely. And I was lucky to meet you before, Kerry, in your Robert F. Kennedy Human Rights, where you obviously try to keep on the great work of your father's ideals. And I was thinking, though, do you ever feel anger at the person who took your dad's life? Would you get over that in time? And do you do that through religion, or how do you forgive people for doing something like killing your father?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting about that. So my dad was shot on June 4th, and then he died on June 6th. So I remember I was 8, and I was my brother told me to tell me he had passed, and I went to my room and I cried, and then I said a prayer for my dad, and then I said a prayer for the person who killed him, and I said to God, just don't let something happen to that guy too. I just didn't want anyone to have to go through the grief and the sadness and the loss, and I didn't want any responsibility for it. I just wanted there to be peace. So in a way, I kind of forgave him right then and there. Just forgiveness is a funny thing. You know, I think forgiveness is, I think, often less about the perpetrator and more about the victim and the victim's finding peace. You know,
you don't really forgive because the perpetrator needs it. You give, forgive because you need peace. My whole grieving really wasn't about anger. It never was.
Your mother is remarkably still alive. Isn't that right, Ethel?
Yes, she is. She's so great. She's 92.
That's incredible. And she's well.
She's well. She goes swimming every day. She does crossword puzzles and plays. And she has never beaten, I mean, she's never lost to any of her grandchildren or her children in backgammon. At least that's what she said. But she... But she knows she plays backgammon for hours every day, and she's really good at it, and she's great.
Well, that's
fantastic.
Wonderful news. Kerry Kennedy, president of Robert F. Kennedy Human Rights, thank you so much for taking the time out to talk to us this morning.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.